So welcome to the Lightning Talk session here in Saul 3. The way this works is we have a bunch of presenters. They have submitted their slides in advance. They're going to run on the laptop right here, with the exception of Stefan, who's coming to you live from the Shack Space in Stuttgart and is the first presenter. So we actually did get one Lightning Talk from a peace mission. And I think that deserves a round of applause for these guys. Could you get that? So I will load every presenter's set of slides or graphical element. If they want to proceed to the next slide, they will say slide. When they have 1 minute left, I will say 1 minute. I will also give them a 30-second warning. And when they have 10 seconds left, I will go like this. Any time between the 1 minute warning and the beginning of the 10-second countdown, a speaker may request a 1 minute additional time extension. If the audience chooses to grant that extension, after the speaker asks, "Can I have more time?" the audience will go. And if the audience chooses not to grant the initial time extension, they will say something like, and then immediately when your presentation is finished, you will vacate the stage. And the next presenter should know exactly where they are in the order. Come on up to the stage and we can proceed from there. So are you guys ready to go? Stephanie, ready to go? They probably turned him off.
Hello?
Okay, hello? So Stefan, you're ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Okay, so your 4 minutes begins now.
Hello, this is Stefan, transmitting live from Shack Space in Stuttgart. I'd like to present the Free Rainbow Tables project, which could use actually your help in several ways. In case I'm breaking up or there are other problems, we have an article, Free Rainbow Tables, on the Congress Wiki, where all the important information resides, so you have easy access in a kind of structured approach. This project is several components. We are using the Berkeley Open Infrastructure for Network Computing to actually make the tables with the project name with lacking vowels. That's the distributed rainbow table generator. That's what's running on your computer to make the tables. Then the next thing you need is RCrack IMT. That's a multi-threaded tool to actually read these tables. You will need these. You will need this tool, else you can't use the tables. And then, of course, we have people, which can include you. This is, of course, people who provide computation power, seed the torrents after downloading, who provide conventional mirrors, and who will develop all the things. And, of course, we can use always new people. Accomplishments in 2010, we have new team members, for example, Papa Smurf, because you see in the cracking community, choosing your nickname works a little bit differently. And we have a Facebook page, isn't that awesome? And we have Twitter. And last but not least, we have CUDA support for table generation. That means it is shaping up a bad year to be one of those unsalted hashes trying to hide your plain text, because as you see, the speed increase is massive. This is an old high-end card, 9800 GX2, it computes a work unit every 2.5 minutes and uploads about 5 megabytes. You don't need to worry about your upstream or your screen getting dodgy. Boink lets you configure everything. You can control the usage of your GPU and your network, so you won't clog your upstream by lots of graphics cards, as shown in the picture. Then we had the first presentation by a developer, Quell, in Norway at the University of Bergen at a conference dedicated only to passwords. The slides and the videos are online. They will give you a lot of background information on rainbow tables in general and the Free Rainbow Tables project. This is also linked on the wiki, so if you need more background information, just look there. You don't have to write down the URL. Quell was also so kind to create a list of development goals for the next year, which is all about what developers should be doing, what everyone else is going to be doing. So if you're interested in interesting cryptographic problems in SSE2 programming, check that out. And you can, of course, contact the developer directly. We have his email here. It's also linked on the Congress Wiki. So, do we have any piraten in the audience? Well, you're helping, but you are on place 70 at the moment. And guys, you're getting by. Thank you. Better than just
30 seconds. Oh, your audio died.
And we go. Okay, basically that's it. I'm finished. Thank you.
All right, Stefan, turn your video back on, give a nice smile and a wave. And give him a round of applause. All right, thank you very much. That was the, I think that was the first remote lightning talk ever given at the Congress. So congratulations for that, but we have a lot of talks left. So one final smile and a wave, one final round of applause, and we will jump right. Thank you again, Stefan, but we are going to jump right into the next talk. 50-50, are you in the audience?
It's 25-12.
What? Okay.
Hello? Is this working? Yeah.
Okay, also a note to all presenters, please be sure to adjust the microphone so that it is pointed towards your mouth, because the further away you get from the microphone, the less and less and less people can hear you. Do a quick audio check. 50-50, are you prepared, and will you say slide when you want to advance your slide?
Yeah.
Okay, so on that note, you have 4 minutes starting now.
Hey, I'm working on a project called F2Fify. It's a replacement for the program called Spotify, which is a program developed in Sweden, Slide. It looks like that down there, and it plays music from a central repository. You can play music you don't have on your local computer. You don't have to pay for it because it's ad-financed. And every now and then you get an ad in your speakers, and you get 320 kilobits per second if you pay and 160 if you don't. It plays local MP3 files, but not any other format, which is funny because it actually streams in OGG, so they have implemented that already. Fine. Then what are the problems with this model? Well, it's non-free. We don't have the source code for that program. It's a centralized repository, which we have no control over. They have been deleting a lot of music that they don't have the rights to distribute. And, well, we want to be able to play any music, just not in that repository. And you can't help your neighbor because, well, you can't share anything that's on a central repository with download restrictions. Well, and that's no local downloads. You can't save the music locally. Slide. What is the solution to this then? Well, we need free code. We need decentralized repositories. I have chosen a model which is friend-to-friend based. So your friend shares his music collection, his or her music collection over a socket, and then you can play all that music, and then that person can play all your music. So you're helping out each other. And well, there's no need to download locally, but you have the possibility for like portable players and such where you don't have an internet connection. Slide. This is how it works technically. You create a local index, which then goes into a database. Database then gets exported to a JSON file, which is imported on the other end, and you ask for the file's MD5 sum together with your UUID, which is a whitelist. And you the other side checks the whitelist and says, ah, I allow this. This guy's my friend. He can download all my music and play it and whatever. And then the data gets sent. So I would like to have help developing this. Right now, slide. right now, that web page is not up. It will be up in an hour or so. And, well, email me if you want to help me develop this. It's all written in Python. So thank you for your time.
Most excellent. All right, next talk, problems of the criminalization of aviation accidents. You clocked in at just under 3 minutes, which is exactly the kind of thing that we're going for. And you're prepared? We've got the...
It works now? Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Take it away. 4 minutes.
All right. Thank you. I'm Ben Zika. I'm a researcher, and I'm also on work on the analysis of aviation accidents in a small company, Slide. And there's a problem that is close to my heart, and I thought I'd make everyone aware of it. When there has been an airplane crash, there's an investigation by an independent government body, which is also independent of the regulative authority. And they try to find out what happened, what did the hardware do, what did the software do, and what did the people on board do, and also air traffic controllers and any other involved people. And the main goal, of course, is to prevent a recurrence of that type of accident. So they look at everything. They look at maintenance records. They look at education and training of the pilots and crew. The goal is very explicitly in the multilateral contracts governing the investigations not to apportion blame. Slide. How do they do that? They do what we call kicking tin, that is going to the crash site, picking up the debris, looking at the pieces of metal, looking how they fractured and how they broke, what burned, where any fire did come from, what were the ignition sources. They will obviously, I forgot that on the slide, they will look at the flight data recorders and the cockpit voice recorders to figure out what happened, what the aircraft was doing and what the crew was saying. They will interview the involved persons if they are still alive. They will analyze the debris, as I already said, slide. And in some cases, there's also then a criminal investigation. There is often a prosecution for negligence or sometimes for manslaughter. And the goals of the criminal investigation, rather simplified, is to apportion blame, to say who is guilty, who is to blame, to punish the guilty parties, and to create a deterrence. And that doesn't work very well for aviation accidents because usually the pilots don't want to die. They are not negligent in that way, and they are particularly they don't act with intent to crash the airplane. Slide. And obviously there's a conflict between these two goals. Unfortunately, we very often have both of them. We have the accident investigation with a goal to prevent further accidents, and we have a criminal investigation with a goal to punish people. If you're criminally prosecuted, you of course have the right to remain silent. I think this is the case in almost all civil societies. But for the prevention of accidents, the testimonies of the involved people, of the crew, sometimes of flight attendants, of air traffic controllers, is vital to find out exactly what happened and also to find out why people did that. We find that in almost all cases, the things that the crew did made sense to them at the time, although it later turned out to be the wrong thing to do. And so we need to find out what the motivations were for the actions. Slide.
1 minute.
Thank you. A few examples. Concorde crashed because a piece fell off of another aircraft that started a bit earlier, and the technician who installed that part on the aircraft was fined. It was sentenced to a suspended prison sentence and was fined. There was a turboprop that crashed into the Mediterranean Sea near Palermo. The crew was sentenced to long prison terms in absentia by an Italian court, and there was an Amazon over Brazil, there was a mid-air
30
crash,
seconds.
And the American pilots were also indicted, and they chose not to return to Brazil. Slide. And in the ICAO Annex 13, which is the multilateral contract governing accident investigations, it explicitly says that it will seriously affect flight safety if this isn't rectified. Thank you.
DNSSEC myths. Are you ready to go?
Yep.
Okay, great. Don't forget, between your 1 minute and your 1 minute warning and the start of the 10-second countdown, you can request additional time just by saying time or signaling anything to the audience that if they are prone to give you that extra time, will make them go. Or prone to deny you that time, go. So don't forget, you only have a chance to do that once your 10-second countdown has started. That is it. And the clock has been reset, and you're ready to go in 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, so my name is Richard Belgrim from the Swedish Top Level Domain, and I wanted to present something about DNSSEC here, and we've been doing that for the last decade and been in production the last 5 years. Slide. So Daniel Bernstein had a presentation day two about his high-speed, high-security crypto stuff, and it was mostly FUD and strawman arguments against DNSSEC and not presenting his own solution. So I want to give my presentation about these arguments that he had. Slide. So the first one was about how you measure DNSSEC deployment, and he's measuring that by counting the unique IP addresses, and I wouldn't do that because do you count users?
Pause. That's another thing that I forgot to explain yesterday. When we run into some kind of technical problem or something's happening on the stream, I will go pause, grant you an additional 30 seconds, and then move to correct the problem. Audio Angel, did you want to explain where people should be standing so that they can be seen by the streams? Move to the light. Okay, so I apologize for cutting off the flow. You can start at whatever point you feel is good on this slide, and I'm going to grant you an extra 30 seconds for the interruption, and maybe a round of applause for letting me. So go ahead and continue.
Yeah, so you wouldn't measure the number of internet users by IP addresses. In this case, you would measure it by the domain names. And for example, the top 10 registrars in Sweden represent 90% of the domain names. And for example, the Czech Republic have 100,000 domain names that are signed. And that's a bit different to the 1,000 IP addresses that he found in the SexSpider slide. He has a program that's called Unhash, which will reveal your song content, but this is not true because this program will just use a dictionary and then convert the dictionary over to a hash and then match that hash what he finds in a DNS. And that you can already do in regular DNS, or you can query the Whois or the free services that are available from TLD. So this is not something that's particular for this one. And you won't find anything that's not in a dictionary, so you can't reveal anything that is in DNS by using this program. Slide. He also says that you cannot trust the root, and that was in a case where the U.S. government closed down various web pages through the ICE agencies. And in this case, there were a court order, and they went to the registrars, and they changed the name of service pointing to deceased websites. And what I wanted to say is that if you don't trust that country, move your domain name to another TLD or another registrar where you have a better jurisdiction. On the internet, you can easily move from one country to another rather than in real life. Slide. DNSSEC doesn't protect the last mile. Well, that's true if you only have DNSSEC in your resolver at ISP, but you can install resolvers in your mobile phone. For instance, the Nokia N900 have DNSSEC support. You can also have it on your own laptop. You can install it in sub-resolvers, etc. Slide. .org is signed, but look, Wikipedia.org is not signed. And, well, that's true, because when you sign .org, you only sign the information that you're authority for. And you don't give DNSSEC to your customers, because you have to do it yourself. You're delegated the namespace Wikipedia.org to yourself, and you have to do DNSSEC yourself. And Wikipedia.org are using GoDaddy. GoDaddy are now supporting DNSSEC, and they can thus do DNSSEC. And this is also true for DNS Curve. If DNS Curve would be used for .org, then Wikipedia.org wouldn't be signed as well. So we have to do it in all the levels in a TLD tree. Slide. You don't know what DNSSEC can be used for, and also we have HTTPS, thus you don't need DNSSEC. But you need the DNSSEC in order to get the translation from the domain name over to the IP address. But you also get the protection for other stuff. You can store sensitive information in DNS. Slide. you have to pre-generate signatures. And that's not true. You can do it on the fly. And even Dan Kaminsky, have the Freebird software they can use. And the reason why most people don't do, can I have 1 minute more? Yeah. So, the reason why we don't pre-generate signatures in our case as a TLD is that we don't trust the secondaries. And we have 150 servers outsourced to 4 different companies. And we want to do it in our hidden masters and then distribute the information out on the internet. But there are software that you can do on it on the fly. Slide. DNSSEC doesn't support dynamic content like PHP. That's not true. Well, you can. The PHP is done on the web server, and DNSSEC only, or DNS only points to a web server. And you can do dynamic updates. For instance, you have it in France.com, and .com will be signed next year, so you can, there, you can do dynamic updates. Slide. And the frequent resigning is an administrative disaster. Well, it's true if not, you're not handling your song correctly, or you have a monitoring of your systems, but that's also true if you do other technologies as well. If the technology breaks, then your system breaks. So you really have to make sure that you know what you're doing. Slide. You're recommended to do 1024-bit keys. That's not true. The current recommendation is 2048, but you also get elliptic curves as well coming to DNSSEC as well. So you'll get smaller key sizes. Slide. And the software implementation never gets it right. Well, that's true because you have to actually use the software in order to find the bugs, and all the software is not bug-free in the beginning, and it will get better and better. Slide. And how does Alice learn Bob's public key? Well, you publish the key in the DNS, and you have DNSSEC, and thus it's safe. Thank you.
Alrighty, reset the clock. 1-1, are you ready to go?
Yeah.
3-2-1, go.
Okay, hello, I'm from the MoinMoin project. MoinMoin is a wiki implemented in Python, and we are currently working on a new major release, the version 2, and we have almost totally rewritten it. Slide.
Pardon?
It's maybe interesting if you didn't look for a while. It's very, very different now. We are using lots of external libraries. We have outsourced lots of stuff. We have redesigned our stuff, how it works internally.
Pause.
What's the problem?
Oh. Additional 30 seconds is granted. Apologies for the interruption, and begin whenever you wish.
Yeah, slide, please. Okay, for the templating, we use Jinja 2 now. It's a nice templating engine from the Poku project, also written in Python. The complete theme code was rewritten, so if you try to write a theme for MoinMoin, you maybe have a better experience now if you do it for Moin 2. We are now doing XHTML, HTML5, to be exact. And we have jQuery and some nice other stuff for support. Slide, please. One major improvement is we have unified all items now. We don't have pages and attachments anymore. You have one type of object, it's called an item, and it can be anything. It can be a text page, it can be a PDF, it can be a graphic stuff, or just an ISO image, or MP3 file, or Orgwarbis, or whatever. And additionally to the data, you also have metadata, and it can be arbitrary stuff. It can be a specification of the MIME type, of the history, of the access control lists, and we also have a content hash. Slide, please. The storage was also cleaned up. In the version 1, it was all a bit messy and mixed up. The user interface and the storage code was mixed. In Moin 2, it's now clearly separated. You have user interface code and you have a storage API, and you can plug in miscellaneous backends. You can mount different backends at different places into the namespace. You can XML serialize stuff and unserialize it again. We have indexing, and we are using SQL Alchemy for the index. Slide, please. Also, the user face got cleaner because all this different stuff in Moin 1 is now unified, and user interface got easier because it is unified. You can do files in the same way as your wiki page text content. So it's at the same time much easier now and much more powerful. Slide. Moin 1 had a bit trouble with the internal infrastructure. We did line by line parsing and creating HTML on the fly. This doesn't work for more complicated cases. In Moin 2, we now convert the input format to a DOM tree internally, then transform this tree, and then finally generate HTML from the DOM tree. And this is now perfectly valid and well-formed. We support different formats, RST, DocBook, MediaWiki format, MoinMoin format, Creole format, and output is valid HTML5 usually. We support also code highlighting using this Pigments library. You can highlight all sorts of code. Slide. Well, to be short, we outsource lots of stuff.
1 minute.
We use Flask as microframework now. Jinja for templating, Babel for i18n, we use Blinker for internal events, and Flatland for data form processing and validation. So it's less self-made code. Slide. MoinMoin is 10 years now. It was a little celebration at a EuroPython. Slide, please. And if you want to have
seconds.
A closer look, look at our website, moinmo.in. It's Indian domain. And this presentation was made by Jesse Inc. If you don't know it, have a look. Thank you.
Do we have the FatLab video? FatLab video. Moving right along, Cypher 7.
Test.
Ready? Yeah. 3, 2, 1, go.
Hey, I'm Lexi, and I'm an organizer of the classical Capture the Flag hacking contests. Actually, I didn't want to host another contest, but a request has been provided to me that there are a lot of people out there who still desire to have the old style hacking contests. Unfortunately, the last one got canceled because everybody wanted to play and nobody wanted to contribute. So I'm here to ask for contributions for you to write vulnerable networked services. And in order to make it a little bit more attractive, we are thinking of deploying a meta game for those contributing services. So those people will have an inside game of its own. If you don't know what a classical Capture the Flag content is, it's more like there are virtualized server images which contain a lot of vulnerable services, which are then simultaneously provided to all the teams, and then the teams start to fix their own services and exploit the other team's services. Well, whoever defends himself best and whoever owns the other teams most wins. Slide. So we got a call for participation. We need your help. If you want to show all the fellow hackers how good you are, then please contribute a service. Thanks.
Henry Story, are you in the audience? Okay, and OpenSCAD.org is a demo. So we're actually going to switch over to the laptop on the podium. Special exceptions were granted for persons with demos that could not be presented any other way. However, the time it takes to set up their demo is also included in their 4-minute window, which will start now.
Do you hear me? Okay, okay. So, I'm Marius Kintel. I do my hacking at the MetaLab in Vienna. I'm going to tell you something about some software I'm writing called OpenSCAD. OpenSCAD is a 3D modeling tool for programmers. And I'll just program something for you instead of talking about it. So this is the user interface. We have a text editor. You can write code. evaluate it. Circle. You can write for loops. Goes like this. And rotate, for instance, around the z-axis. We can translate. Around tactics, we can do new circles. Boom. So here we have like a circle with 10 circles around it. Now we can do a CSG operation. We can take a difference between the first circle and the second circle. All this is now 2D, so let's go to 3D space. We can do a linear extrusion. Whole thing, extrude is called. Some curly braces will help. Boom. A little bit tall, so we can set the height of the extrusion to, for instance, 20. Here we go. Let's add some twist to it. Twist equals 45 degrees. So here's 3D model. So let's make it parametric. So we define a module called column, radius, height, number of tags. Let's instantiate it, column. 12, 25, 8. Public, let's use the parameters, height, radius, number, radius. Boom. So, and add another column and translate it. Make the radius a little bit smaller. Bang.
1 minute.
And then we can do a difference this time in 3D space. Boom. So now you have a 3D model that can be 3D printed or exported and used whatever you want with it. The rest you will figure out yourself. Can I have some more time, please? This is hard modeled in DXF.
30 seconds.
With this, you can read the DXF file. You get the twisted hard box. This is a more complicated DXF model. You can extrude this and do a 3D version of it. This was, I got 1 minute extra, guys.
Time.
You forget to give him a minute extra.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. I didn't hear you clearly ask for time. He was given? Okay, so we're going to give him a minute and 30. The minute that you gave him and an extra 30 seconds for my fuck up. Is that all right?
Fine. Okay, so let's go back here. This is an enclosure for a bus pirate that I modeled a while ago. I want to laser cut this. So I define the material thickness, and I slice it automatically, this because we support slicing, just like this. And I can then, for instance, do an automatic layout for laser cutting. So you can just laser cut the model.
1 minute.
Automatically creates the number of slices based on your material thickness. Can I have this, please?
Pause.
Boom, 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 boom. Okay, hi. So, laser cutters. How many of you guys know what laser cutters are and are familiar about them? You're not really laser cutters. Okay, some people. Laser cutters are really, really cool pieces of equipment. And they have one problem.
you are forced to use an archaic operating system that some people are enemies with. It starts with W. You're forced to use their proprietary drivers, and you're forced to do fucking CorelDRAW.
30 seconds.
That sucks. But we are actually going to fix this for you, because a friend of mine and me are writing an open source laser cutter driver that will run on the other operating systems and will make possible for you guys to actually use laser cutters without dealing with this strange OS and this strange modeling tool that is not really a modeling tool. And the next speaker will actually talk about this, which is Amir Hassan.
Okay, and this presentation involves a video, which I will start right with the clock in 3, 2, 1, go.
Hello, my name is Amir Hassan. Well, as Marius told you, we are currently writing a laser cutter driver. This is not only about freeing our laser cutters from Windows and CorelDRAW, it's more about doing the cut really the way we want it to. Currently, the laser cutter drivers, like employed with the most popular brand of laser cutters, it does not support nice optimizations, customization of cuts, vector engraving, and a lot of things we usually want to do. So this is our current state of what we are capable of doing. Three things laser cutter driver you have to take care of. First of all, you have to support all the front ends. That means like a lot of graphic applications. Like QCAD, Inkscape, and a lot of others. Then you have to support vector cutting, and you have to optimize for it so you don't fuck up. And you need to support raster graphics. At the moment, the laser cutter driver is basically doing all the basic tasks. We don't have a proper install, we don't have a proper build. Documentation is scarce, so we need a lot of fucking help. We just released it a few days ago on the MetaLab GitHub. And so I'm asking you to help us getting it to really usable state for everybody, yeah, for end users and not just developers. Well, I think we should just look now at this lovely video and how it engraves, vector engraves. One of these pictures. Yeah, usually you would raster that, and that takes a lot of time. But by tracing it and doing vector engraving, you're much faster, and that's one of the ways you could optimize your jobs. Thank you. Laser cutter, a CNC machine that does cutting with infrared laser. Quite expensive, but a lot of hackerspaces were able to buy one, so it's in the range of doable. Any more questions?
For my remaining time? You haven't even reached your 1 minute mark. I mean, you can.
Yeah, it would be very cool if you would give me a really, really, really smart question. Yeah.
The 1 minute.
Was the video in real time?
Pardon, I didn't hear.
Was the video in real time?
Ah, no. The jobs are...
Please repeat the question.
The jobs are not in real time. You send them and then you start the job. What I forgot to tell you is we are using cups as to feed the jobs, so you can just print from the applications like you are used to.
30 seconds.
With a usual driver. What kind of model do you mean?
Please repeat the question.
Will your driver be bound to a certain model?
Ah, yes, it is at the moment, but they are all pretty much alike, so if we have testers and people supplying like example jobs, it should be easy to adapt.
And just apologies, just as a reminder, you can get a 1 minute extension of time, but you have to ask for it. Do we have the Salami Rocket presentation, or is this just a video that you want me to show?
I would like to talk a short second, and then I would like to show the video.
Okay.
That is actually one of the projects.
Wait, hold, ready? 3, 2, 1, go.
That is actually one of the projects I did with a laser cutter at a very, very, very early stage of the driver. And it's about a salami rocket. Salami rocket is, well, salami is food. And as food, it has the function of, it should provide nutritional value, energy. So that energy can also be used for rocket propulsion, I assume. I saw the television series Mythbusters, maybe some of you know it, and they tried to do that, and they fucked up. So I tried to redo it, and you know, as far as I came is, I have a rocket motor that fires and produces a lot of pressure. And well, I'm halfway done, so that summer I should be able to finish it. Slide, please. That was last summer, our last test. You know, you can look up all the other tests at that wiki page. What you see is salami burning with energy as a burning agent. Well, in the end, it fucking worked. Thank you.
How do you ignite salami?
There is a black powder ignition charge in there that is supposed to heat the nitrous oxide until it splits into nitrogen and oxygen, because then you have a lot of oxygen you can burn. And there is a little paraffin wax in there that should heat the salami initially, so it really can start to burn, and then it starts to smell funky.
The next presentation, BOFH. Adrian, are you in the audience? Negative. Marcus Holtas. Oh, good. Okay, we finally have a presentation we can give.
I'll test.
And ready to go in 3, 2, 1, go.
Hi all, my name is Marcus Holtas, and I'm going to talk about alloys. Alloys is the advanced log data inside system. Slide, please. It is meant to be used as a data leakage detection tool, and it does that by collecting all log data in a single sink. Then the log data is being split up into fields, put into a database, and on the database you can do analysis and create reports and create alarms depending on what you want to find in the log data. Slide, please. This is a possible setup which can be can go quite complex because the system is meant to be scalable and meant to be very flexible. Slide, please. It's been implemented in Ruby on Rails using a MySQL database and Ajax web frontend functions. It's been OSS from the beginning. It's been developed in 2006 and 2007. That once the development started, and we just did a rework and some optimizations. Slide, please. This is the main page. You see the main components, the log flow, some indicators on system load and message intention, etc., and a nice stoplight which indicates that we have some major alarms going off regarding data leakage. Slide, please. We've done some work on the main and major tools like Apache, HTTP daemon, and some other quite common tools, PostFix and Cisco. But there's lots to be done to make it usable for other types of system and for other types of standard logs. Slide, please. This is the main analysis page. In the bottom half, you see log messages, which are a small excerpt of log messages having entered the system. You can hover with your mouse above the single fields and click them to select them or deselect them. By doing so, you create a filter which is displayed in the top half of the display, and this filter you can save to be used later on as a selector for reports and for alarms. Slide, please. There's a small graphics engine inside, so you can create nice little pie charts to see where your web traffic has come from, etc. Slide, please. Before starting such a project, it's always interesting. Well, you have to consider that there are some implementation issues. When you start with log collection, the first thing you find are not data leakages, but configuration errors, because often you have log files that nobody has ever looked at. So you also find lots of attacks, and of course you have to consider data protection issues, because Alois goes after the data, not after the people creating it. Slide, please. You can use it for statistics, of course. That's a possible dual use tool when considered in the data retention discussion. But one of the possible applications is that data retention is about collecting our personal data and retaining it. And the problem is that most of us don't even know what we are generating for data ourselves. So it would be interesting to set up an Alois for yourself to kind of find out what data you generate which could maybe retained. Slide, please. We are currently in the Apache incubation process. That is, since October, this is an Apache project, and everyone is invited to help us, to support it, to download it, to install it, and to have fun with it. Thank you.
And actually, we're running very, very far over time, so I'm going to go back to some of the presentations we may have missed. Privacy and transparency, or privacy and transparency in the social web, are you in the audience? Do we have the FatLab video presentation presenter somewhere in the audience? Okay. Do we have the TV Be Gone presenter in the audience? Okay, so actually what we're going to do, since we've been at this for an hour, we're going to take just a quick 10-minute little stretch break. Apologies. So yeah, we will be back with you at 12:30, just because we started at 11:30 this morning. But we will be back with a TV Be Gone Lightning Talk at 12:30. Quick round of applause for all of the presenters in the first half of the Lightning Talks today. And we will see you guys back here at 12:30. Thank you.
Just in case you're wondering what's going on here, we are in the middle of a break for the Lightning Talks, trying to set up some stuff. For example, a laser and a PlayStation, play some games. So please take your time taking a seat. There are plenty of them. And we are about to start at 12:30, which is just a short time away. You have a quick joke.
Hey. Hi, my name is Jesse Zbikowski. I'm a hacker and an artist, although I don't really like to say either of those words. They're both fucking kind of dirty to me. But I just wanted to talk to you for a couple of seconds here until you kick me off stage. It's fine. But I've been in Europe here for a couple of months, and I started out as a Linux programmer, and now I'm getting paid to be an artist somehow. And I'm mostly just going around and giving talks about, hey, if you're an artist, you don't know what the fuck you're doing, maybe you should try to think like a hacker, you know? Like, actually, these guys have some really fucking good shit going on in their heads. For instance, the hacker looks with his eyes, not with his mouth. This is what I'm saying. Like, you fucking, whenever I try and help someone and the shit doesn't work, it's because they're listening to someone who says, oh, goddamn, you know, it's like, it's got to be like this and like that. No, you fucking just look at it for real. Like, for instance, this @mega168, it's a silly story. But I just wanted to turn it around and say maybe there's a few things that artists can teach hackers as well. So 1, 2, 3, real quick. Number one, if you get caught, if you get in trouble, say it's art. It gets you off the hook every time. Pause. Number two, the job of the hacker is basically the same as the job of the artist, which is to take something meaningless and create meaning from it. It's like,
pause.
And number three,
the last one, always yield to the hands-on imperative, especially when it comes to women.
Nick, I think we got hacked. Huh? Nick, we got hacked. How could this possibly happen? I don't know. Well, we got hacked, I think. Nick, would you please take over?
I leave the room for 5 minutes to go to the bathroom. Well, anyway, give Jesse a round of applause for hacking the lightning talks. I just also want to say your LaserNet demo is ready to go?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Sorry, I'm kidding. Yeah, no, I wanted to give a round of applause for all of the Lightning Talk presenters that we had, because they all they followed the directions on the wiki, they submitted slides in advance, they've all come in really, really great. Can you have a huge round of applause for all the Lightning Talk presenters? And perhaps maybe you can see it. Have you guys think the lightning talks have been okay this year, that they've gone pretty well? Have you enjoyed yourselves? Yes? Okay. Because one of the reasons that we had very specific directions on the wiki, asking people to properly submit slides, give an abstract, keywords, and things like that, was so that we could try to raise the quality of the lightning talks this year, and also improve the flow, timing, and things like that. And all apologies to Jesse for kind of embarrassing you here, but presentations like that are why we went to a specific directions format this year, to try to increase the quality and things like that. So now we have another awesome demo, OpenLays, and then as soon as he gets back up here and I give him the mic, I'm going to start his 4-minute time. If you were scheduled in the 11 o'clock, we have a FatLab video and another presentation. We will continue to cycle through those if you're in the audience now. But without any further ado, I'm going to get my clock back up and ready to go in 3, 2, 1, go.
All right. Hello, I am Hector Martin, a.k.a. Markhan, and this is a project that I've been working on. It's called OpenLays. It's an open real-time laser graphics framework. But before I talk about OpenLays, let me talk a little bit about how lasers work. There's a laser back there. It's DIY. And the way it works is there's a laser that turns on and off. It projects a beam into two mirrors that are connected to two very fast motors called galvanometers. Those motors basically move the beam up and down, left and right, onto the screen. What on earth? Okay. To paint a picture on the screen. So that's how lasers work. And these motors move really, really fast. They move at about audio frequency, so kind of like a loudspeaker. So it makes sense to drive them using audio equipment. So we use a simple USB sound card to do that. And since we're using audio hardware, it makes sense to use audio software. So I built OpenLays around the excellent Jack Audio Connection Toolkit, which is a real-time Unix sound server for Linux and Unix. And OpenLays is basically built on top of Jack. And there are two main parts. There's a output processor, which has a little GUI that looks like that. And you can tweak all the laser settings and all that stuff. And then there's a library that you can use to draw graphics on the screen in vector format. It's kind of like OpenGL. And it's called LiboL. So you can use this to render lines and do 3D and 2D graphics, as you just saw. And you can basically, write any kind of interactive laser application with it. So since it's all real time, it makes sense to, of course, do video games. That's one of the main reasons. So, but of course, we can do 3D graphics. And we can do games. And okay, so games work really well. But since it's real time and it's using audio, it's actually synced to an audio channel. And so I was doing some demos and some other things. It's a real-time audio visualization. I'm sure you recognize the music. So I also did a little demo, and I decided to try doing a tracer, because an effect like this can only really be computed in a bitmap format. So there's a tracer that finds the lines of the effect and converts it into laser. And I thought, well, what happens if I apply this to a video stream, an actual video? So I found this shadow art video on YouTube that works really great with the algorithm. It works way too well with this. And that's what this looks like. It's real time from a video file to laser to the projector. So that's about it. The code is open source. You can grab it at my website at markkinsoft.com/openlays. I don't have plans for building the projector yet, but it's you can do a DIY. It's not very hard if you know a little bit about electronics. It costs about 200 euros. So that's about it. Thank you very much.
Actually, Sorry. I have just a quick announcement here. Thank you so much for coming here. I was supposed to coordinate a setup with him last night that never happened. He came in right on time. I didn't think this was going to happen over email. Can you give him a huge round of applause for getting set up, ready to go, tested, and with a great huge demo. Thank you so much. And then I believe your colleagues are also going to give another demo based on their talk from last night.
Yeah, we're both going to go. So let's see if we can do this thing. Just unplug the power. It's the easiest thing. Pull the plug on the projector. Yeah. Mirror. Let's see if I can do that. All right.
Check. I think the audience will give you, you know, a minute to breathe if you need that.
Check. Okay. So we were going to give a demo on the PS3 on the talk, and we didn't finish it, and we have issues, and we still have issues, so we're going to give the best possible demo we can. We have video issues, so it's going to have to be through the network from a computer. So this is a PS3 Slim. There's nothing connected to it on the front or the back other than Ethernet and power. I'm just going to leave it there if I can. And hopefully this will work. All right. Turn it on. And hopefully, this will boot Linux natively without actually having anything plugged into it. It's flashed on the PS3.
Hopefully. It takes us a few seconds. There we go. And now let's see if it actually works. Oh, yeah. I'm here. Keep forgetting this keyboard layout. Yeah. Yeah, well, it's booting up, so this will happen a few times. It's booting up the Linux, and if video worked, you'd be seeing a nice penguin and all that stuff. But apparently the video RAM is kind of turned off, and we have no clue how to turn it on yet. So that's kind of hard to get video that way. There we go. Just give it a few seconds. It'll work. I think it's trying to resolve. Yeah. There you go. Where's my dash here? I have no clue what my keyboard is. There you go. And what did I botch it? Oh, I have it again. Yeah, UTF-8. Okay. So that's about that's what we can show you right now. No jailbreak, no USB, no nothing. It's flashed. The bootloader is flashed onto the PS3.
You actually have 2 minutes left, and you haven't asked for your 1 minute extension if people have questions.
Yeah, sure.
However, if you do have questions, please find a microphone. We have angels coming around. They will give it to you. This is for the benefit of the people watching the streams at home, and you might as well just ask for your 1 minute time extension right now.
Yeah, pretty much.
Do we have any questions in the audience? One, Mike's coming around.
So the question is, do you actually publish how to do that at home?
Right now it's a horrible, terrible hack. So the idea is to clean it up and in the next month or so get it out there. We will publish this. We did this by flashing through hardware because, well, not because it's required, but because it was the only thing we could pull off by this time. But we know it's possible to do through like just a firmware update. So the idea is to publish a firmware update file that will replace GameOS with Linux like this and basically do this without any weird hardware stuff.
Thank you.
And tools on how to build it and all that. So it will all be public. This is using the exploit that we detailed at our main talk.
Any other questions? Please raise your hand so that we can get a microphone to you.
Shouldn't have called it an exploit. It's not an exploit. It's an epic fail by Sony. Like, it's the code on the PS3 is fine. They screwed up in HQ. Yeah. No, they gave us their private key, basically. So if you watch the talk, they leaked their private key mathematically. So, you know, we don't have to exploit anything. We just sign things. Yeah.
1 minute. I think actually, if there are no more questions, give him a huge round of applause. And we're going to take the next talk that is up is the TV Be Gone talk, but we're just going to do a quick recap of how this thing works and do a little microphone technique check. So right now you're in the lightning talks. Every presenter has submitted material in advance. Most presenters submit slides, which are run off a central laptop. They have 4 minutes to present their slides. They will get a 1 minute and a 30-second and a 10-second warning, which works like this.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Presenters may ask for a 1 minute extension of time anytime between their 1 minute warning and the 10-second countdown. And if the audience chooses to grant that 1 minute extension of time, they will voice their approval by saying something like, and if they choose to decline the 1 minute extension of time, they will say something like. And now we have Sven here, who's going to give us a couple of quick hints and tips on microphone usage for presenters that are coming up here. So, Sven?
I didn't expect this, but I can tell you, if you are up to this podium here, you don't have to actually eat the microphone like this. Just stand clear of the microphone and use it. And everybody, especially the audio angels, will make that you are be heard. Sorry, I didn't get that. And if you actually try to walk around like this...
Sven, he said, hold the handheld microphone closer to your mouth.
Okay, that's exactly what I'm about to do. Try not to wave it around like... Thank you very much. You can kick me off the stage later. But hold it close to your mouth and talk into it and have fun having your session. Actually, that's it. I've seen that some more audience is coming into the room. Please find a seat in the front here and make it quick if you like to sit. Yeah, that's from my side. Thanks. Nick?
Everybody, give Sven a huge round of applause. He's been a great senior herald angel. Guys, give it up for Sven. Okay, so for those of you who are just joining us, we are now in the second hour of the Lightning Talks. If you were supposed to give a presentation in the first hour of the Lightning Talks, we will bring up those presentations later on and cycle through them. But right now we're going to get moving right along with TV Be Gone for the N900. Also, presenters, please introduce yourself. Introductions are a part of your 4-minute presentation time. So without any further ado, if you're ready to go, also be sure to remember to say slide when you want your slide advanced. So are you ready to start, Simon?
Good.
Okay. And he's got his 4 minutes in 3, 2, 1, go.
Hello, my name is Simon Budich, and I won't expand very much on that.
Actually, if you do need to look at your slides, it's probably best to use the handheld microphone. Because what happens is when you're at a microphone that's at the podium, you're supposed to talk into it. And then it's a little bit harder for the audience to hear you when you're looking at your slides as opposed to speaking directly into the microphone. So if you do need to do that. Also, there's another thing here. When we're working out a technical difficulty, I will say pause, and every time a pause has to happen, the presenter is granted an additional 30 seconds of time. So with that being said, you're 6 seconds into it, and you have remaining 4 minutes and 24 seconds. Ready to go? Go.
Okay, I guess we can just get to the next slide. I'll be talking about the a small desktop applet for the N900, which is a TV Be Gone applet. I guess most of you are familiar with the TV Be Gone, which is Universal's remote to switch off TVs. Mitch Altman, the inventor of the TV Be Gone, is here, and he is helping people to build their own ones down in the hardware lab. So there is an open source kit available, and it's a lot of fun to run around and switch off TVs. Slide, please. So. Infrared signals basically are pulses of infrared light, which are usually modulated with about 38 kilohertz. The pulse widths vary between a few hundred microseconds up to a few milliseconds, and usually they employ some kind of encoding scheme, and yeah, there is a package of Linux software available for this. Most, some of you will be familiar with it, which is called LRC. And it has a lot of knowledge about these protocols and stuff. Slide, please. So the N900 is interesting because it also incorporates an infrared transmitter, which is not for IRDA. It's really just an infrared diode to send out infrared signals. And LRC is available on the main repositories, and there are user interface tools to configure your own remote. However, it's still a little bit mess. The user interface of Qt Ireco is very complicated and can be quite confusing. So you have to deal with strange databases to configure LRC to have the codes available. And to invoke a code, you have to open the socket to LRC and request a specific previously configured code. Slide, please. So the other option is to talk to the LRC driver directly. There is a device, and you have I/O control for the carrier frequency and for the duty cycle. You can just write some integer values for timing information, how long the pulses and the gaps should be, and up to 256 pulses and gaps can be written per one write, which is usually enough. There are some weird limitations in the driver, and the real problem is on the next slide, which is a timing problem. If you look at the infrared pulses which get sent out, you notice that they're usually longer than you expect. Ideally you want to sit on the green line, however, pulses are about 141 microseconds too long, gaps are 104 microseconds too long, and, well, yeah, which is a problem if your signals are in the range. Slide, please. So the desktop applet itself is written in Python. It compensates for the sum of the error from the previous slide, and you just click on it. It starts sending out TV shutdown codes.
30 seconds.
Well, I guess we can just look at the screenshots in the next slide. There it is, sitting there. When you click on it, it starts to, slide, please, to show how much progress it has been doing. And at the end, slide, please.
More time.
In the end, it just shows what it just has done. Slide, please.
1 minute.
And, well, I'm finished. Basically, the next slide is just the configuration dialog. So, yeah, that's about it. Thanks.
All right. Do we have the monitoring spyware talk? Okay, great.
One, two, one.
Oh, okay. You don't. Actually, can we have a huge round of applause for the audio angels who have been scrambling to try to make this audio work? Huge round of applause for them. And I actually got some guidelines on using this microphone before the break. Is this an appropriate distance for the podium microphone? We're good? Okay. Also, if you're just walking in, we have plenty of open seats here up in the front. No, we don't have any open Lightning Talk slots at the moment, but we do have plenty of open seats up here. And without any further ado, let me get my timer back on. Are you ready to go? Okay. And so you know that if you're going to use the podium mic, this is an appropriate distance and to try to look and face forward. You got that?
Yes.
Okay. If you do need to look at your slides, it is probably best to use the handheld microphone. Do you think that might be a better option?
One, two, three. Okay.
Okay. And then how close, do you have a mic there? Give us a demonstration of how close you should hold the microphone. Do you see how far away he's holding it?
Yes.
Okay.
This is good? Okay.
And also be sure to keep your microphone there when you're speaking and hold it closer to the head of the microphone so as not to bend the antenna underneath.
Okay.
Yep. Okay, that's good. Give him a round of applause for demoing that. Okay, and without any further ado, I have to set up my timer again. 3, 2, 1, go.
Hello, my name is Tomasz Bukowski, and I'm working on the computer emergency response team in Poland on ISP NASC. Maybe someone is familiar with this name, and I will be talking about monitoring spyware, especially the last year Big Star is used. So why to monitor this spyware? Next slide, please. For fun, for knowledge, of course, for commercial purposes, so because someone pay us to do so, and because the shutting down of the botnets take a really long time. So next, please. What few words about Zeus? So this is a spyware. This is the Zeus is hiding inside the OS by attaching to other system process. The main target is to steal the data from the computer. The data it is on the computer. This transferring from the end to the computer, and also it communicates with a CNC server. It is not infecting any files. It is not scanning or infecting any computers near the infected, and it's not spreading itself. It needs a supporting software, like a dropper or something. And so far, because maybe the new version will do so. Next please. Zeus got a very beautiful configuration file, which is divided to section the static config, and next please, and the dynamic config. We can support many URLs that can contain the configuration file. We can specify the action to the regular expression. What can we do to specific domain? For example, the exclamation mark means that this is the safe domain, and those won't mess up with this URL. And the at sign means that every time we press the mouse button on this page, the Zeus will make a screenshot and send it to the server. Next, please. Zeus got a really beautiful, very user-friendly admin panel. So I hardly seen the any software that is so user-friendly and well-written. Next, please. A few statistics about the version of Zeus in 2010. Next, please. We can see that we have witnessed the major update in this summer. So in the May, the second version of Zeus started up here, and in the late fall, the malware guys was using almost only that second version. Next, please. Here's the more detailed chart. Single sample for the single month contain about 400 configuration files. So this is, I think this is a representative sample. Next, please. And here you can see that malware providers are doing updates very fast. So they are better than users. Next, please. And we performed a few analyses of the second version of Zeus in a third Polska lab. Next, please. The major update is related to a crypto part. They implement the RC4 cryptography inside the binary. They are not using any system libraries for this. And they are storing the binary in the application data folder and keeping the configuration and key initials. Yeah, thank you. The data that is needed to initialize the key, they're keeping it on the register. You can see the screen on the screenshot here. Next,
one
please.
Minute.
They implemented the command line switches, which show the version of the product. Next, please. And we have found they messed up because they are using their own implementation of the RC4, but they are for calculating hashes, they're using system libraries. Next, please. They do the two-thirds because we can hook the system library and dump the plain text data. And okay, so we have, next please, yeah. We have written the config dumper, and next please. Okay, so last slide please.
What?
One last slide. There's a con.
Wait, say that again.
Last slide please, show. If you are interested in cooperation or anything.
You're done. Give him a round of applause. Thank you. Yeah, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to be fair to all presenters. Some people, some of the presenters, do a really good job of trying to get in right under 4 minutes, and you know, you want to try to be fair to everybody. So unfortunately, you have to. I try to be somewhat strict about the rules to make it a fair playing ground for everybody, and that includes even cutting you off for 5 seconds there. Do you think that's appropriate? Okay. All right, so do we have Elib Text Day, and the attachment decided to fail on me. Okay, all right. All right.
No. down, down, down.
Hello. My name is Gernot, and
Well, you know, if he wants to just jump right into it and go for it, I'll let him do that. Okay.
May I?
3, 2, 1, go.
Nick, thank you. Hello, my name is Gernot, and this is a call for articles, which involves work, and therefore we thought that perhaps to help you decide to participate in this call for articles, you might be persuaded by winning gaming hardware. So we got someone to get us some gaming hardware if you participate. And it's basically, you can read it over here, about science fiction and science. And we are right now getting some articles. I looked at it yesterday before going out and whatever. So there are some interesting articles, and I would be very, very happy if some of you decided to write about their favorite science fiction topic. And we have one article, just to give an example, about input devices, real input devices, and input devices in science fiction, for example, science fiction films, and how those did influence actual further input devices, which is I think, a very, very interesting topic. And if that helped you to decide to write an article, you have time until the 12th of January. It's on this page. It's elib.at. You'll see a big banner when you visit the page. You have a submit form for those of you who like wiki text, and the other ones can just send us an email. We'll put it up and do all the categories and everything. So just write your article, send it to us. We would be very happy. And I think that's about it. So please participate. Thank you.
Okay, do we have any presenters that were scheduled for the first half of the lightning talks that didn't manage to roll out of bed in time to make it and would like to present in the second half? All right. Please come up. Okay. Oh, which presentation?
Bjorn Fisch meets System Top. It was supposed.
I apologize. Last night, some of you know the event server went down, and I had the entire schedule and files and everything loaded into that. So at about, I think that went down. So at maybe midnight when I got out of Sol 1, I started going through emails and digging everything out and attempting to recreate everything, only to have the server and my schedule and everything come back up at about 4 a.m., at which point I tried to merge the two and had not slept very much at all at that point. And so I apologize for some of the fuck-ups there. but without any further ado, Adrian, are you ready to go?
I'm ready.
Okay, so don't forget the tips from the microphone. Also, don't forget to ask for additional time if you need it, just by saying additional time, giving some indication to the audience that if they like you, for them to go. And if they don't like you, to go. All right, so ready to go in 3, 2, 1, go.
Hello, I'm Adrian, and I'm going to talk to you about BRFH meets System Tap. So BRFH is the bastard operator from L, which is a supposedly fictional character with a Unix administrator who doesn't really like his user, so he can annoy them and abuse them in general and spy on them. And System Tap is a debugging and tracing tool for Linux that allows you to really instrument about anything on a Linux system. So that includes a kernel, of course, also application and libraries. And it's really a code injection framework. So now, what does BOFH do when he meets a code injection framework? Next slide, please. Well, that allows you to do many interesting things very, very easily. If you know libpurple, it's the library used in pidgin, for example, to communicate to interface with IAM protocols, so like Jabber or IRC or whatever. And with just three lines of system tap script, you can tap into the library and observe any message that is sent through libpurple on the system. And that's just three lines of code to really write a full featured sniffer and bypassing any encryption, obviously. So it's just an example. I gave a few others there. If you want to annoy your users by preventing them from opening any MP3 files, it's just five lines and it's loaded dynamically. You don't have to rebuild your kernel or anything. That's things you can already do, of course, with custom C code, but you won't do that you won't write a Pty snooper in five lines of code, I think. So there's just a few ideas you can find on the website here, stopbofh.crunch.be. I give some screenshot there. I won't give a demo here. I won't show you some code. I don't really have time. This is really it. I can go in more details about system tap, but I don't think I have much time left anyway.
You have 1 minute and 15 seconds.
How much?
Now you have 2 minutes and 15 seconds.
Oh, okay. Any questions? Okay. The question was, how do system tap works, and can you is it big, and can you run it in an embedded system? So very shortly, system tap actually builds a kernel module, and it requires itself a compiler and the kernel headers and stuff. But once it has compiled the kernel module, you can just put it on your embedded system and load it. So it's just a kernel module. That's depending on the code you write, it will be much or less large, can probably run on an embedded system without problems.
1 minute.
And if you want to know more about how system tap works, go on the system tap website. There's a link from the page there. But
give him a round of applause. So again, were there any presenters from the first half of the lightning talks this morning that did not get a chance to give their presentation? For example, do we have privacy and transparency anywhere in the audience? Do we have the FatLab video anywhere in the audience? Okay. In that case, moving right along, do we have hacking governments in the audience ready to go? Okay, great.
Test, good.
Yep, and if you're ready in 3, 2, don't forget to ask for additional time, your microphone tips, and get ready to go in 3, 2, 1, go.
Hi, my name is Suso. I come from Galicia. I'm studying in Universität Konstanz here in Deutschland. And I want to present you this proof of concept for a talk, which is about hacking governments. This is not about hacking the systems of the governments. This is about hacking governments. So making governments things we want they do, or avoid governments to make things we want they do, like putting patents, surveillance systems, and so. Clear? Okay. Slide, please. What I want to do is I'm doing this because I had some experience in that field exactly. First with some technical hacking, playing with passwords and that kind of things in Unix systems and Linux and so. It was very nice, so the first time I think it will be possible to do it for all the things, so I entered in the .coms thing, but then I lose. It was a lose. I want to remove the info breach. I lose that. Then I realized that it was needed not only technique for doing that, so I entered with radical groups and so. Then we have some kind of things. Some of you know I was involved in that. The indie media, FBI, seizures of disks. We won that that war. The censorship in the Prestige One, which was an oil spink in Galicia. You know the patent things, the hyper-red, and so on and so. So there has a lot of experience here, some with wins, some with losses, and I want to understand that and express that and share it with the community. Slide, please. How to do that? There are some tools in the political science to understand how we win and why we win. This is an example from the University of Constance, which displays the network structure from the patents struggle. You know the FFII, this is the left network, and this is the network from the people who want the patents to do things. There are very different. Slide, please. This is the evolution. In the upside, we have our network against patent, how it was evolving and how it was evolving the other side. So you have a lot of differences, and that also can explain why we won that battle. Slide, please. And this is another layer, not only the infrastructure, also the messages, the narratives which are talking in this Congress helped us to do that thing. So we have tools to understand that. I'm trying to apply that tools to understand my own experience and then share it to all the community to make use of them. Slide, please.
1 minute.
So my intention is to plan. I'm planning to make a talk for the next year, doing that research. This will be the outline. This is my proposal for you. You can say it's okay or not. I'd love to have some feedback from you.
And, 30 seconds.
Can I have some minute for... So, very fast, this is three parts. The first one is, what is an info war? You know the John Perry Barlow statement in Twitter during the WikiLeaks things. Okay, I don't need to explain that.
1 minute.
So, what is an info war? What are info wars? We have cyber wars, networks. We have a lot of concepts, so we need to define that to be able to win that. In the second part, we have some learning lessons from the past. So why we won patents, why we won WikiLeaks, but why we lose the profit thing, why we lose the privacy thing, even when we can do things. And finally, the guidelines for the future. What we need to do to win the next InfoWars we are going to have.
30 seconds.
Last slide, please. So I hope to see you next year. Please, any feedback, I'd love to have it. Okay?
All right. Do we have privacy and transparency in the audience? Nope. Okay. Quadcopter, are you ready to go?
Test, test.
Okay. And then just because you had a version revision on your slides, I just want to make sure that this is the deck that you were expecting.
Yes.
Seven slides. Okay. Great. So we'll reset the clock. And you're ready to go in 3, 2, 1, go.
Good morning. I'm Timo from the UAVP NG project. UAVP is a universal aerial video platform We are building quadrocopters and other flying objects. Slide, please. Like any other flying object project, we have a sensor board with all the usual sensors, like gyroscopes, an accelerometer, and stuff like that. Slide, please. And a control board for actually doing the flight regulation. We published that on the last Congress, so you can buy the PCBs in our non-profit shop and build them your own. Slide, please. What's new, it's the software, the NGOS, the NGO operating system, which aims to be a framework for building your own extensible quadrocopter or multicopter. One part of that is HAL, like hardware abstraction layers. Yes, you can do several different configurations of quadrocopters, hexacopters, octocopters, and all things you can imagine in any way to make them fly. So there's a framework to do that. Usually the implementation of another HAL to for another shape of rotors or rotor configurations, implementation of that takes just a few minutes or at most an hour or something like that. You can also use different controllers, like control algorithms for heading and altitude control. And you can even switch halts and controllers in flight if they're compatible. We also have shells, like real Unix-style command shells on about 5 serial and USB ports. You can use them in flight via Bluetooth or Zigbee or via cable when on ground. So there are like 177 commands predefined, but you can also define your own commands for debugging your own extensions or just for configuring the quadrocopter or whatever you are flying. Slide, please. For user-side configuration, we have behaviors. You can configure them via the shells. So these are 2 example behaviors. Like, I think the slide says it all.
1 minute.
If you have the low battery voltage, it says just to sound an alarm. Or if you lose remote control reception, it should sink slowly and not crash anywhere where you don't want to go. Slide, please. The best of it, it's now open source, like in GPL version 3, and not in some partly
seconds.
Commercial license where you are required to pay if you want to sell pictures taken with that software when you're using that. So it's all out now, you can use it. Slide, please.
More time.
If you want to contact us, meet us, just come up to the UAVP NG desk. It's just in the exit stairs and near room 1. You can visit our webpage, ng.uavp.ch, join our ERC channel, or just email me. If you want to know some basics about quadrocopters, there's also my talk of the Frostcon conference in German at frostcon.tv. And yes, if you have questions, come up, or if you have time, we can take 1-2 short questions now.
You've got 20 seconds for 1 question.
What's about the wind stability?
We're going to pause for the interruption for the question.
What about the wind stability of the quadcopters?
Repeat, please. Didn't understand you.
The wind stability of the quadcopters.
Ah. Yeah, since you have gyroscopes on it, we can regulate against wind to prevent the quadrocopter moving to this side a bit, so we'll keep it stable. And with GPS, you can hold the position. Thank you.
All right, were there any presenters from the first half of the scheduled lightning talks today that did not get a chance to present this time?
Hi. Yep. I was really tired. I arrived ill and I've been going to bed too late. So my name is Henry Storin. I work.
Oh wait.
Oh.
We're just going to do a quick microphone check.
All right.
Could the audio angel just come up to the stage and give us all a quick lesson on how to use the podium mics and the handheld microphones very quickly?
Hi. So step one to make everything worse is stand here in the dark, hold the antennas so we don't have an audio signal, and turn your back to the audience. It was not you. So speak loud into these microphones. Don't eat these. Hold the microphone in the middle and near to your mouth. That's basically all. And stay in the light.
And then how far away from the podium mics should they be?
Well, you have to get really close to these, but don't eat them. So
okay.
For tall people, these microphones would be better.
I'm tall. Okay.
Okay, give the audio angels a huge round of applause for coping with all... for all the great work that they're doing right now and coping with us. Most of you missed it earlier this morning when we started the lightning talks at 11 o'clock as scheduled. We had a live lightning talk given by Shackspace in Stuttgart. Yes, we actually got that working, I promise you. Did anybody here actually see that? Okay, so you can vouch for me that it actually worked? Okay, great. Now, without any further ado, Henry, you ready?
Okay. Hi.
Wait. Yeah, oh. I know you weren't here, but traditionally I give you a 3-2-1 countdown. You have 4 minutes to present. I will give you a 1-minute warning, a 30-second warning, and a 10-second warning, which will go something like...
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1,
and most of the presenters have actually forgotten about this today. I've had to give them a nudging reminder, but any time between your 1 minute and your 10-second warning, you can request an additional minute from the audience. If they choose to grant it to you, they will do something like... and if they choose to decline it, we'll do something like... So, you got that?
Yeah.
You're good? Okay, so...
I was here the last few days.
Let me get the timer ready again. And 3, 2, 1, go.
So, I've been working on privacy and topic for the last few years. Next. The government wants to, so it's interesting, the recent body scanner issues shows how deeply the government wants to get into the transparency issue, discovering more and more about us at airports, and yet you can think of WikiLeaks as in some ways doing the same to the government. Next. So on the issue of transparency, I kind of think that it's not because everything is in the open that everything is understandable and transparent, right? This is a game of Go by Go Sagan in the 1940s, and you have to study this game in very great depth in order to understand what is going on. So understanding and having something in the open are still two very different things, and I think that might explain partly why WikiLeaks, for example, needs so much work of interpretation to go with it. Next. So here, this is a really great video, but I forgot what I was going to say about it, but I think it's next. And what I really wanted to come to was the issue of that these two people here demonstrate is the issue of information asymmetry in two very different ways, right? Next. Facebook is mostly this type of information asymmetry. Millions of people, hundreds of millions of people whose information is visible by the guards of the Facebook empire, and yet each person in the Facebook can only see a very small section of it. The famous panopticon devised by Jeremy Bentham in the 1800s. Next. So if you, it would be nice if you could leave one of those panopticons and move into some somewhere else, but you can't really, because every other system you're moving into has exactly the same problems as the Facebook one. So the largest panopticon wins, because it's going to be the most comfortable. You're most likely to meet other people you'd like to speak to. Next. So is this, does this have to be like this? Well, let's consider old technologies such as the telephone. Next. With a telephone, for a very long time, you're able to use any telephone to contact someone, whatever network they're on, in the whole world, right? Next. The same is true with email. You can contact anybody in any system around the world. And with the web, the same. You can buy your web server and link to any other web page in the world. Next. Now, if we add semantics, we could each of us have on our web server descriptions of ourselves and link to other people around on the web. And by doing this, we can create a distributed social network. Next. Perhaps I'll have, can I have another minute? Great, thank you. The project I'm looking at, I discovered this summer, which I'm really intrigued on, is this Clarezza project, an incubator project Apache, which is 100% pure Java. So this is more because I'm a Java person, and perhaps people here who are into Java and Scala would find this very interesting. It's 60% Scala, so it's got a Java infrastructure, OSGI based, but it's 100% semantic web. So there's no SQL database. It's just all you can use either Jenna or Sesame or any of the other RDF databases. So if you want to kind of start playing around and getting an idea of what it feels like to be in a semantic web world, this is a good place to a fun place to start if you're into Java. Next, that's for people more in the Java space, but I'm going to be working this year at the W3C on getting secure authentication using SSL standardized by the W3C. There will be a Web ID working group, incubator group.
30 seconds.
And also, if you're looking at what the W3C is doing, consider the W3C starting a federated social web incubator group where they're getting all of these diaspora and all of these other ELG distributed social networks to start playing together and get them to work together properly so that we can all use them. Thank you. And that's my website.
Did we miss any presenters that were from the first or second half of the audience, or first or second half of the lightning talks today? Nope. And with that, let's have one. We have no more presentations left. If there are no more presenters in the audience, huge round of applause for all of the lightning talk presenters here at the Congress. And just because we have one more minute, it's not really a lightning talk, but this came in, and I thought it was a pretty cool little video. This was filmed. No, give it a round of applause. All right, thank you guys very much, and enjoy the rest of your Congress. Thank you. Actually, I apologize. There was one lightning talk that I completely forgot. I fail. Give me a big boo. And the ironic part about this was one of the first ones submitted, which is why I completely forgot about it. But it's four slides. I see that. So as an apology for that, do you have a live demo planned after this?
Yes.
Okay, so we have a live demo planned right after this. And because of my screw up, we're not going to... Do you think that it would be fair for me to just not time him on this one? So take it away.
Hello, test. Hello, so my name is Helga. I'm from Berlin, Germany here. And today I would like to introduce you my project, which I am doing like 2 years now. It's a quadcopter design also, where I do all my own software and hardware. And yeah, next slide, please. And in my project, I started off designing a single processor design at first, where I used only one processor and a CPLD to control all four motors, and now it has evolved to a distributed design also comparable to the microcopter project and the UIVP. And what my approach is a little bit different. I use different interconnect buses and also make my own speed controllers, which you in the top left slide, part of the slide, you can see my flight control PCB, where you can see the inertial measurement and the processor. And I use a very modern processor, also the ARM Cortex M3 from ST. Where I'm planning to do a lot of all the algorithm in one processors, not like the other projects where you have a couple of processors working together for the algorithms. So it's very simple hardware, very clean design, and I use a CAN bus like in the automotive for interconnecting the speed controllers, which you can see at the bottom. So in the left part of the speed controllers, you can see the MOSFETs, which are very modern parts. Like it's called direct FETs. They're very they can carry very high currents and very small, and you can cool them very properly. And then I have also a special driver for these MOSFETs, which is in the middle. And to the right is also the same processor I use in the flight control unit, which has to the right a CAN bus driver that allows very reliable interconnect, because the other projects they use I2C for the speed controllers, which is not very good if you build a large quadrocopter design. And so this CAN bus is a very good alternative, so that you can build larger designs and have reliable signal interconnect between speed controllers and the flight control. And on the top right of the slide, you can see a navigation PCB where I have a GPS, a magnetometer, and a barometric pressure sensor, which is currently a little bit under development. Yes, and that's basically my concept. And today I also brought a prototype that maybe we can see flying outside after the talk. And yeah, and so the current state of the project is kind of, I released my schematics under Creative Commons license. So I can, next slide, please. Sorry. This is just the software that I use is I currently use C# for that, and because I'm used to developing with that. And there you can see the gyros and accelerometers and some data from the quadrocopter. Next slide, please. And yeah, and so at the Congress, I wanted to finish some more prototypes, and but I only finished the third prototype. The fourth one is not working yet. And so what I think what the project should have is that maybe I will distribute some PCBs so that people can assemble themselves, because it's it's hard for such a small project to start off using ready-made PCBs. So I will give away some PCBs in the future. And what the current problems I have is a little bit that the toolchain for this STM, which is a very nice processor, very fast, very modern processor, it doesn't have a good open source toolchain yet. And so it's, I don't know if somebody has an idea how to solve it, because if people will get involved in this project, it's a really big problem that with the Atmel processors, which are very nice, you have a very good open source toolchain, it's really easy to use. But with a much richer modern processor like the ARM Cortex-M3, you will be somehow stuck with very, very difficult toolchain installations, and also with the firmware library. I use non-free library at the moment, and so this is maybe a big hurdle to overcome in the project. If there are many people involved, then you will need an open toolchain and everything. But at the other hand, I don't want to sacrifice the performance you have with this processor. It's a really great processor, so this is where I'm standing at the moment. And please feel free to have a look at my website and have a look at the source code, which is GPL version 3 released already for the flight control stuff. And yes, feel free to ask any questions, please.
Okay, just a couple of notes, and please do this for the rest of Congress. If you'd like to ask a question, make sure that you're asking it into a microphone, and if for some reason this is impossible, please make sure your speaker repeats the question. And so with that, continue. Okay, you can go ahead and ask your question.
Okay, thanks. So it's not a question as much as a comment. I did a workshop the day before yesterday with a Cortex-M3 as well, and there is a GCC toolchain and newlib, and it works really well. So okay. I'm happy to show that to you if you'd like
okay.
to.
Okay, fine. And what processor is it? What brand? Or
that was an NXP LPC 1343, but the same toolchain works just fine for the ST.
Okay, good.
I mean, it's the same CPU core, also on Cortex-M3. So
thank you.
Yeah, sure.
And where can we see a live demo in action?
Maybe it's inside. I don't want to recreate, like the previous speaker said, like an air incident or something. you know, that we won't have to investigate then, and so maybe better on the outside. I will take it outside, just in front of the BCC. They have some more space, and yeah.
Okay, great. Give him a round of applause. And also, thank you guys for sticking around. I know I ended the lightning talks completely neglecting this talk, but that's what happens when you try to prepare these things at 6 o'clock in the morning after having been up all day. So guys, thank you very much. Please enjoy the rest of your Congress. Thanks again.